Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of The Ballot Box. Today, we're going to talk about a small but fascinating country, the country of Albania and the Balkans. Chris is going to take the lead here, but we're also going to add on some questions and comments. But before we get starting, I want to ask you guys how everything's going in the UK. So, Johnny, why don't you tell us how London life has been since we last spoke?
I'm sure London life in general is quite nice. I've been horrifically busy this week with many things, so it's not been too pleasant. Last weekend was my birthday though, which was quite nice. But since then, I was immediately on Monday plunged into horrific amounts of work. So since then, not so great. Yeah. How about you, Andres?
I'm doing all right. Mexico City is good. It's finally starting to rain, which is always, it's always a pleasant time of year. And most importantly, I got to teach my students about Duverger's Law last week. So that was exciting for me and for about like 10% of the class. And then the other 90 felt it was terribly technical. And they weren't, is this political science? You know, I had to tell them that it's the best we have. it's the only law, but it's basically one of three laws we have.
I mean, so. if you can't persuade Americans of Duverger's Law, then you're really in trouble.
I think they came around to thinking that it was a good explanation of the two party system in the US, but
yeah,
it's tough teaching those kind of more technical aspects.
For those who are not political scientists, Duverger's Law is basically the law that says that under a first past the post system, things will naturally drift towards a two party system. So that's what we're referencing. I am very much of the view that Duverger's Law tends to apply at the constituency level, but not on a national level, which is one of the reasons why you can still get multi-party systems in first past the post countries.
Yes. Not to make this too much of a side, but my supervisor, Dr. Rekha Diwakar, has actually done a lot of work with this in regards to India and saying that it's basically, while it looks more multi-party and as a kind of aberration under Duverger's Law, at the regional level it often is a kind of series of two-party systems. They're just always the same party.
India is a very good example of Duverger's Law in operation, because it's basically every state is its own two-party system, broadly speaking.
There's a wonderful, I think what I enjoy most, like the text I enjoy most about Duverger's Law, is one by William Riker called An Essay on the History of Political Science.
Mm.
It's really good. And it talks a lot about India.
I've also read that. It's a very good article.
Yeah. But wait, we've already plunged into
we've
the
already
deep
plunged
side.
To, we've already we plunged, plunged into deep
to, into yeah. the deep political science. Before we do that, some light introductions. Chris, tell us how the cats are doing in Manchester.
The cats are good. I tried to take a bath yesterday, but I found that Mabel had decided that the bath was her new home. That was slightly irritating, but apart from that, things are very good in Manchester. One of my favourite things to do in our local neighbourhood in the pre-lockdown days was to visit our local market, which appeared on a Saturday, which was impossible under COVID restrictions, and we've now had a couple of weeks of it back again, and I feel much better about that. That's really lifted me up. So that's made me feel quite happy. Had a couple of very fine lunches from there, so thank you very much to the lovely people at Levantine Market. If you're ever in Manchester, come down this way, it's great.
Yeah. Sounds lovely.
And is right. Manchester in the grip of election fever, Chris?
No, because Manchester is effectively a one-party state. So, I have moved wards since the last time I had to, I had a vote, and I've moved from a ward which was 75% Labour to 65% Labour. So I feel like my sense of choice is much increased.
Yeah, we've similarly are not in any kind of fever. I feel like I see the most publicity for if people aren't aware, there's a man called Count Binface, which I don't think is his real name, who's been standing in elections for a few years now, is standing for the London mayor, and this is very telling how quiet this mayoral election has been. Is that this is the candidate I seem to see and hear the most about at the moment, and people doing interviews with him, etc. To take away from the fact that there's not really much of a competition between the main two candidates in this one.
Yeah, I mean, similarly for the Greater Manchester mayoral election, I had a look through the manifestos. I tried to have a look through the manifestos the other day, which turned out to be very quick because only Andy Burnham seems to have produced one. because Andy Burnham, last time around, won about 2/3 of the vote in Greater Manchester. And I think the broad feeling is that he's been a pretty good mayor. So really, there's no reason for anyone to bother, which is a bit depressing given that the mayoralty covers 2.5 million people. There's both significant powers on offer and significant issues to be debated about, which unfortunately we're not getting that debate.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll turn back to these next week.
But... yes, we will complain about this in more detail when we discuss the UK elections next week.
That's going to be a fascinating episode, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So on to the tiny but fascinating country of Albania, yes. which had elections on Sunday. Last Sunday, and has taken quite a long time to count votes, right? But they're finally in. Yes. And I know very little about Albania, and the first thing that comes to mind are the novels of Ismail Kadare, who's fascinating, great writer, but very much of the kind of communist past. But Albania now has like a vibrant or a kind of interesting democratic setup. Chris, would you say that Albania is similar to other Central and East European countries, or are there some like very kind of distinguishing factors that set it apart?
So in some ways, yes. So for those of you who listen to our Bulgaria episode in particular, I think a lot of what is coming is probably going to sound familiar. There's similar issues with state capture, for instance, albeit it is in many ways still a functioning democracy and has made some very real progress since 1990, coming out of a particularly difficult inheritance. Then on the other hand, it's quite unusual from the perspective of other CE democracies. So, for example, Albania is pretty unusual amongst CE states in having a very polarized political atmosphere, in which there are two main parties which very aggressively head off against one another, and where majority governments are, it's not unusual. Despite the fact that Albania now has a fully proportional electoral system, whereas in the past they had a kind of mixed system.
How about its kind of religious makeup? I think that is maybe one of the factors that makes it stand apart, and kind of did it play a role in this election?
Albania is one of a few kind of Muslim majority countries that can be said to exist in Europe, along with, for example, Bosnia, Kosovo, arguably Turkey, North Cyprus, depending on which of those you describe as countries or as in Europe. So obviously it's unusual in that respect. But it does have significant minorities, religious minorities as well. particularly in the north. There is a very large Catholic population. In the south, there's a very large Orthodox population. And we're going to probably start talking about the north and the south a little bit, because the north and the south is a kind of fundamental divide in Albanian politics. And there's also another group called the, let me get this right, Bektavi. I probably pronounced that wrong, so apologies, which is a kind of Shiite Muslim group that blends their Islam with elements of Sufi Islam. But the largest group is Sunni Islam, and it's a little bit more than half the population. Albeit, that's what the census says. That's not necessarily how things actually work in reality, because Albania's particularly hardline communist leader, Enver Hoxha. Hoxha was notorious, and his kind of byword for extreme paranoia. He's almost treated as a joke in the West at times, because Hoxha, first of all, was a very close ally of Tito, and then he split from Tito and became a very close ally of Stalin. Then when Stalin died and Khrushchev did the secret speech and announced de-Stalinization, he denounced that as revisionism and split from Stalin, split from the USSR, and sided with China in the Sino-Soviet split. And then when China began economic reforms in the 1970s, he declared that revisionism and split from China in what was called the Sino-Albanian split, which led to Albania being incredibly isolated. He's also famous for the fact that Albania was arguably, depending on how you define it, the first officially atheist country in the world. Some people's, there are ways in which you can define it in which the USSR was, so it's somewhat contested. But Albania was different from the USSR in that it was much more brutally repressive of religious groups, and that did not apply to any particular religious group. It applied to all of them. So there were and religion was repressed to the extent that you could really only practice it in private. Clergy people were brutally killed by the regime, so on and so forth. So that's led to a population that in practice is pretty non-religious and religiously tolerant of one another, I think it's fair to say. So for instance, the prime minister is from a Catholic background. The president is from a Bektavi background. The opposition leader, I think, is from a Muslim background. And although there are divisions between all three of those men, and they all hate each other's guts, none of it seems to be based on religious backgrounds. And they are all cooperating in movements which draw from other religious groups as well. So...
yeah, I think Albania is really, for the region, really unusual in that regard, that there's not a clear alignment of like ethnicity and religion. As if you think about the kind of former Yugoslavia, I mean, there is in many areas a kind of common language, etc. But the nationality is very much defined by the religion. If you're Catholic, you're a Croat. If you're Orthodox, you're a Serb, kind of thing. But yeah. Albania, I suppose, being more like something like Germany, etc., in that you can belong to the same nation, but the religion, they can have different religious backgrounds as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and probably one thing that does help here is that while within Yugoslavia, within the kind of area that we typically think of as the Balkans, the former Yugoslavia, in many ways, religion is the fundamental divide between. Mm-hmm. Between nations, in the sense that, so for example, there's a little lie that we tell about Serbs and Croats, in terms of the fact that Serbian and Croatian are mutually intelligible enough to really basically be the same language. They're basically dialects of one another. But the fundamental difference between Serbs and Croats is Serbs are Orthodox and Croats are Catholic. But Albanians, the Albanian language is incredibly distinct on its own. It's its own branch in the Indo-European family. So there's nothing even really close to it. And Albanian nationalism is fundamentally a kind of lingual-based nationalism. So the language is the kind of identifying, unifying thing. Albeit within that, there are dialects, which is the division points between North and South. And those themselves have some religious consequences because of how those dialects came about. But in terms of the background, so the fact of the Catholics in the North and the Orthodox in the South, for instance, is tied to the history of Albania and which also interacts with those dialects.
Yeah, I think we should also also mention quickly, although there's not really as much need to dwell on this as there has been with other countries in the region, that there is a small ethnic minority, but it's probably much less, at least much less politically significant than it was in Bulgaria or Romania. But there is a small Greek minority in the south, although it has for the last couple of decades, I think, that the Greek minority party tends to just run in alliance with one of the major parties.
Yes.
It ran on the Democratic Party lists in this election as well.
Yes.
So we're not really thinking about having kind of minority parties and ethnic minority politics in the same way as we were in Bulgaria.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is it should be said that for various reasons, it's widely believed that the census undercounts the Greek minority as well as the Roma minority, which is also very much in Albania as well, and which has a lot of the problems that Roma minorities tend to have in the region, which are very unpleasant. It's also worth saying on the Greeks that to some extent it's also seems to be the case that the Greek population is dropping for the quite logical reason that Albania borders Greece. And as much as Greece has had a lot of problems over the last few years, over the last decade, it's still a wealthier country than Albania, quite easily. Albania is pretty poor, even for a CE country out of the EU. I mean, in GDP per capita terms, it's poorer than Belarus or Ukraine. So that's a kind of, but albeit richer than Moldova.
So obviously this is a country that was under communist rule and a particularly authoritarian brand of communism. Some will probably classify it as a totalitarian state at a certain point, but you know, deeply authoritarian rule of Enver Hoxha. But then, you know, obviously it transitioned to democracy, and that's why we're talking about the elections now. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about the transition to democracy.
Absolutely. So, I mean, as we said, Hoxha ran a particularly hardline regime, very isolated from the world. He died in 1985. So that brought to power a kind of slightly more liberal communist elite, albeit still very much authoritarian, totalitarian. And Albania did not have an opposition movement. We've spoken like similarly. The transition in many ways resembles the ones that we've talked about before in Bulgaria and Romania, in that the regime didn't really seem to have any major signs of internal tension, but And actually, in some ways, it interacts with those transitions in that the regime saw what happened in Romania at the tail end of 1989, and began to worry, and student protests began in the cities, which encouraged it to believe that it needed to transition to democracy. So they announced elections for a constituent assembly, and they allowed the formation of opposition parties, with the main opposition party, which is still one of the major parties today, the Democratic Party, which is largely the party of the Albanian right, being formed. And they held elections, but they actually ran under their Communist era banner as the Party for Labour. And when they won the elections, which they did not to an astronomical degree, but to a degree where they'd clearly won a decently sized majority, they declared it as a victory for Marxism Leninism. So this is not a party that is obviously transitioning towards, hey, actually we're capitalists now. This is a party that is basically trying to do, and in fact the communist leader became the first president of under this new constitutional setup. There were kind of a lot of controversies about this. So the election was broadly considered to be free and fair in terms of how the ballot worked, but particularly in rural areas, there was a lack of information resource for opposition parties. And so that created that was broadly seen as creating an unfair playing field for the parties. And particularly in the cities where the opposition party, where the Democratic Party was stronger, there were protests, general strikes, and eventually elections were called for a year later, and the Democratic Party won them. And by that point, the Party for Labour had transformed itself into the Socialist Party, which is now the other dominant party in Albania. And since then, all Albanian elections and all Albanian politics in some ways has fundamentally come down to a fight between the Socialist Party and the Democratic Party.
In a sense, not too atypical transition to democracy, obviously with its own individual characteristics. And would you say that Albania, since the transition to democracy, has been plagued by similar sort of kind of the problems of new democracies that we've talked about, such as like corruption scandals, maybe disenchantment, fractured politics, etc.? Or has it been spared by some extremely lucky circumstances, these internal issues of democracy?
I mean, I think it's fair to say, like, we talked recently about Bulgaria, and I think in some ways there's some similarities there. In some ways, I think Albania is worse, which, given that I was very downbeat in our Bulgaria episode, as those who listen to will remember, is probably not the greatest recommendation. So both parties have... So this polarization between both parties has been incredibly vicious, often personality based. Sorry if my cat is distracting Jonathan and Andreas. She's in a nutty mood at the moment. So this polarization has been incredibly vicious, and both parties have at times been criticized for authoritarian behavior, for rank corruption, and there's an interaction with state capture as well. As we talked about in our Bulgaria episode, state capture is when the system is captured by outside forces. In this case, particularly the Albanian mafia, which is very strong, very powerful. Albania has been described by at times by people like the US State Department as Europe's only narco state, which, yeah, is a description which seems credible. Albania is a frequent supply route for drugs into Europe, particularly marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. So yeah, in some ways, it's a country that has a lot of the issues that we associate with CEE countries. But from that, it also has some of the issues of countries we've talked about in, for example, Central America, such as problems with armed gangs, interference with organized crime into politics, and so on. So there's some expertise for all of us here that we can draw upon.
So we'd be interested in talking a bit about these the two main parties, just because this is such an interesting feature of Albania in a regional context, in that it's had these it's nearing a two-party system. I think maybe two-and-a-half-party system might be.
I think two-and-a-half-party. I think two-and-a-half-party system would be very fair in its current form, especially.
Yeah, but they also, these two parties are the same two parties from the transition, basically. And the third party, which I'm sure we'll mention as well, has also been around for a decent period and is a splinter of one of the main parties as well. We're not talking about anything like when we were discussing Bulgaria. There's obviously in that election, there was a lot of electoral churn, but also just in general, and this is the case for many sort of post-communist countries, that there's been a lot of volatility, new parties springing up.
Yeah, I mean, in particular for post-communist countries, it's incredibly rare. In fact, Albania might be the only one, come to think of it, where the first anti-communist party survives as a major party. I struggle to think of any country off the top of my head where that's the case. Hungary is probably actually the only one now, I come to think of it.
I don't think anyone's glad that happened, but never mind.
In actual fact, even in Hungary, it's not true, albeit Fidesz started off as a major participant because the first party to win an election in Hungary was the Hungarian Democratic Forum. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, even there.
Because even the Czech Republic, which had one of the more stable systems for a long time,
yes,
also it's kind of fallen apart a bit now.
So first
of all, is there any kind of explanations for this that you've come across as to why these two parties
I think there's two reasons that come to mind, which, as is often the case with two-party systems, there's both a system explanation and there's a cultural explanation. So the system explanation is that even though Albania now has a pretty proportional list PR system, for a very long time, Albania was using versions of mixed member systems, which were heavily rooted towards first-past-the-post constituencies, where elections were essentially being won by whoever won the constituency seats, and the PR seats were essentially acting as a kind of supplementary. So, of course, all the kind of common rules of first past the post about two-party systems and being disproportionate and so on came up. And
this mean that the Duvage's Law comments were not completely perfunctory, Ed, for all?
No, the Duvage's Law comments are completely relevant to this conversation. So, yeah, surprisingly. So, and obviously that means that, and particularly because, typically speaking, the system was 100 constituency seats to 40 list seats, and you're talking only about a quite small number of constituencies, that made it very hard for kind of third parties to kind of break through. Obviously now we're in a different environment, but that's the case. And there's also kind of wider systemic things, like, for example, the fact that media in Albania is incredibly polarized. So there's basically hardly any media outlets in Albania which aren't fundamentally biased towards one party or one of the two main parties. So that wider environment also obviously creates problems. There's the other reason is the cultural one, and I'm going to try and tread carefully here because I am not Albanian, and having read into this, I understand that it's very easy to annoy Albanians about this because I understand that people basically tend to overreach on this a little bit. But I referenced at the start the divisions between the north and the south, which are to some extent historically rooted. I'm not going to try and do like a full history of Albania because we'll be here all day. But basically, Albania was Ottoman controlled throughout most of its history, the Albanians were considered to be relatively rebellious within the Ottoman Empire. For example, one of the reasons why it's got this kind of interesting religious patchwork is because the Ottomans essentially tried to forcibly Islamicize them to kind of try and make them more docile. But the Ottoman bureaucracy was less able to penetrate in north than in the south, which is why, for example, there are different dialects in the north, were historically different dialects in the north and the south. So the dialects in the north are usually referred to as Geg dialects, and the ones in the south are referred to as Tosk dialects. And the Gegs are historically had one of Europe's last tribal societies up until the communists came in. And the Tosks were kind of more integrated into the Ottoman Empire, and this was a kind of fundamental divide for many decades. I don't think it is the lingual aspect is so much anymore. People often use this frame now, and I think it's at best out of date, albeit there's still clear path dependencies based into it. But the Gegs were essentially the root of the pre-war regime of Albania, and then the Communist Party was Tosk dominated. So you can kind of see how that kind of pans out in the democratic transition period, where you end up with a socialist party that is primarily based in the south, and an opposition party in the Democratic Party, which is primarily based in the north. So we often, when we're talking about CEU politics, complain that, you know, parties are disconnected from society, they don't represent general cleavages. To some extent, the Albanian parties do kind of seem to represent a genuine societal cleavage, albeit possibly not an ideal one, because it's a kind of regional, to some extent ethnic, my understanding is that it's quite common to see Tosks and Gegs like intermarrying now. People move around a lot, particularly in the cities. So it's not like there's a feudal north and like a developed south or something like that. Like people who write about Albania from the west often seem to write about it as if it's in those terms. And there is, that stuff hasn't fully gone away. Like there's regions of the very north, particularly because Albania is very mountainous, that where the Kunun, the traditional tribal overlord, is practiced to some extent, but it's not like that's not the average Albanian experience like even in the north. So there's some societal routes for these, for this divide too.
And are the two main parties far apart, kind of policy-wise as well?
Not really, no. I mean, there are policy differences, but it's very frequent to see complaints. And I had a read of the OSCE report, and it comes this morning, and it came up in there that actually the main political fights are fundamentally about personality. So it's primarily personality divides that seem to be defining the terms of political debate. There are differences. So, for example, the socialists in power have implemented progressive taxation again, when the Democratic Party had a flat tax, and the Democratic Party wants to reintroduce a flat tax. The Democratic Party is also seemingly a bit more socially conservative, particularly in terms of you know, religion, LGBT issues, which are a big big place where Albania is seen to lag. The socialists are a bit more progressive as well, and there's also something of a divide on nationalism as well. The Democratic Party, the Albanian right, leans more towards kind of concepts of Greater Albania. We've kind of referenced with like Kosovo. There are large numbers of Albanians in the region outside Albania, and so many Albanians would like to see a kind of Greater Albania in an ideal world. Obviously, there are a lot of kind of tensions over that, not least with like the countries that those Albanians are in. But there's also tensions within Albania, because the sizable majority of people who of Albanian ethnicity outside Albania are of Geg ethnicity. So if you bring in Kosovo, which is basically people who are entirely Geg, or like the Albanian regions of what is now North Macedonia, you shift the kind of classic ethnic divide in Albania, which I know I've just said that it's overly done, but that does seem to be something that be a slight concern in the background of all this. So it might actually reorientate Albanian politics a little bit, which is currently pretty thinly divided between these two parties, typically.
It's a very interesting consideration about kind of co-ethnics outside of the country and how that could influence the electoral balance, etc.
Yeah, it's something that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about irredentist movements. How actually reshaping a country affects it, regardless of what's going on.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And another big question that doesn't have to do with necessarily that kind of populations, but would kind of end up restructuring the country in big ways, would be eventual access to the European Union, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And is there also a split between parties in terms of their orientation towards the European Union? Or is there a consensus around that, as there is in, I think, some Eastern European countries?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, both parties are pro-European, and they do the very typical thing of both parties accuse the other one of holding them back. For example, there are kind of some interesting differences on other international relations. So the socialists are currently quite friendly with Turkey, which the Democratic Party accuses them of holding them, being one reason why progress in the EU is slow at the moment, for example. It's more treated as kind of like a valence policy issue where performance on European integration is seen as something that everyone wants to kind of try and achieve. And it's in many ways it's obviously one of the most democratizing aspects of Albanian politics, and it's one of the things that's this election, in common with the previous election and now frequently the case, Albanian politics has this tendency to kind of throw up political crises as it's coming up to election time. So in this particular case, a very sizable portion of the opposition just walked out of the parliament in 2019 and have been protesting ever since. But the EU will then come in, as happened here and as happened in 2017, and negotiate between them some changes to electoral laws that will then be passed by the government, and then they'll have an election and things will be okay for a little bit, and then they'll have another political crisis. That's a fun thing too. But yeah, so the EU is clearly having a kind of positive impact in some ways in that respect, because it's keeping the terms of political debate going. Yeah, and I mean, it's worth referencing the fact that these are two parties that literally had a civil war in the 1990s. There was a 6-month civil war between them after the very contested 1996 election. So yeah, there is no blood loss here. And in terms of democratic problems, like, one of the biggest ones is that there is almost always violence on election days in Albania. And that was the case in this campaign. A local politician was shot during the election campaign, and there were knife fights in parts of Albania too. So that really is telling how sharp this polarization is between these two forces.
So what were the main issues in this election then, specifically?
So the basic one, the fundamental one in this election, was essentially about the Socialist Party and Edi Rama and the extent to which it is corrupt, in league with organized crime, and leading into authoritarianism. So the opposition has for many years accused the government of all of the above, and this was particularly made worse by a scandal in 2019 when wiretap evidence appeared of Socialist politicians speaking to organized criminals about boat buying, which is a common practice in Albania, sadly, and even rigging a selection in a city in the country to favour the interests of a particular organised crime gang. And these conversations, it did include the Prime Minister, albeit it's not clear from what is heard from him how much he actually knew or knows, as well as other cabinet ministers. And the Socialist Party has been inoculated in crime and corruption in many ways. I mean, the first interior minister that Rama had when he was in government now sits in a jail cell on drug trafficking allegations. The many MPs are drawn from criminal convictions. There's nothing there. But also, the Socialist Party isn't exactly wrong when it points to the other parties and says, as always happens in these countries, well, you've done corruption and crime too, and also accused them of kind of trumping it up for electoral advantage, blah, 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 blah. This stuff is always murky, and it's never quite clear when you're talking about a country like Albania, it's never quite clear to what extent anything is true. So I'm trying to tread carefully. Because conspiracy theories do prop up all the time. And the problem is that some of those conspiracy theories might actually be true. And this came up in the campaign in other ways. So the campaign, so the OSCE report says quite rightly, so I'm fairly confident with saying this, that the election showed disconcerting amounts of using of state resource to benefit the ruling party, which is essentially a kind of form of biasing. So the socialists, for example, were found to have during the campaign a great big database of every voter in Albania, which seems to have literally been stolen from the state. So that was not pleasant. On the other hand, Edi Rama, the prime minister, is probably one of the most charismatic politicians that Eastern Europe has ever produced. And he is an incredibly capable and popular man. He has pushed forward some genuine reforms in government as well, albeit it's always the case with this stuff. To what extent are you pushing it forward, like genuinely, or because the EU is making you? Like stuff on judicial reform, for instance. And he has done, I mean, as I say, he's done things that people from a centre-left point of view, I think, would generally like his progressive taxation. He's more pro-LGBT rights than his opponents, albeit he hasn't actually done much on the issue, but being vocally pro-LGBT rights counts for a lot, I think, in that region. So I think he gets one for that. And he's ran a gender balanced cabinet, which is nice. So there's not like nothing there that I don't like, to put it bluntly. As much as like I think that these allegations of corruption are very incredible, and they do include him. He has been accused of having money in secret bank accounts abroad, and as I say, he is involved in the tapes, albeit I'm not quite clearly sure from them how much he actually knows or is involved in that stuff. So in some ways it was an election that was polarized around Rama, because all the opposition parties essentially announced that they were against him. And the two main ones, the Democratic Party went as far as to form a common list with 12 other parties, and the Socialists announced that, basically the third party, which is the Socialist Movement for Integration, essentially announced that they were going to form a government if they could. And in fact, the president comes from the third party, and said that if Rama won a democratic election, which I think is probably a very important phrasing, he would resign. So this election has become incredibly polarized around the figure of the prime minister.
So do you want to tell us about the results?
So the Socialist Party won 74 seats on what was actually their highest vote percentage ever, at about 49% of the vote. The Democratic Party won 39% of the vote, which is actually up from last time, but what really damaged the opposition was the Socialist Movement for Integration lost about half its votes and seats, which I suspect is both because of controversies around the president, who is very closely identified with the party. I mean, his wife is literally the leader right now, which I mean is always telling. And because being president, because the president's officially a non-partisan position, limited his ability to campaign, which he's always been a very effective campaigner. So I think that probably played a role as well. And then there's another party which we might talk about a little bit more detail. They got 3 seats, but apart from that, that's the other party is called the Social Democratic Party. But yes, so yeah, so you can see from that that this polarization continues in very strong form. And it's the first ever third term for any Albanian prime minister, which is obviously significant itself.
This is a unicameral system, right?
Yes. Yes, it's a 140-seat unicameral system. And also it's worth saying as well, we didn't really discuss the constitutional details as well as start. The president is indirectly elected and a largely ceremonial role. So this is not, for example, when we spoke about Bulgaria, to some extent that's almost kind of leaning into being a semi-presidential system. The presidency is very weak in Albania, despite the fact that the president has decided that Rama is his nemesis and that they're going to try and fight it out anyway, because that's how Albanian politics goes.
And how about the electoral system? It's
now semi-open list PR in 12 constituencies with a very low threshold. So the threshold is only 1%, albeit most of the constituencies are so small that you're never in a million years actually see someone with 1% of the vote get in. So the smallest constituency has 3 seats. And then the largest one is Tirana, which covers the capital city, which has 39 seats, and those correspond to the counties of Albania. The introduction of semi-open list voting is new this year as well, it's worth saying, and it is controversial because the socialists put it through unilaterally in June with a package of other measures which had been agreed with the opposition parties. And I think that's worth mentioning because with list systems, there's basically 2 ways of doing corruption. You can either corrupt inside parties by basically buying places further up the list, a system in which people can vote for people is in some ways more democratic. Many people think it's more democratic, and you know, having the idea of being able to choose candidates is quite a nice one. But where it can fall down is it might encourage vote buying, where candidates are, particularly in a country like Albania, where candidates might be to some extent supported by organized crime gangs, it can allow those gangs to encourage vote buying on behalf of individual candidates rather than just the party, which can obviously accentuate problems in those kinds of cases, where in countries where vote buying is more of a problem. So yeah, that choice is controversial, and the opposition parties did not support it, I presume for that reason, although I haven't actually found anything to that effect.
And did the opposition parties accept the results of this election?
So broadly they seem to have done, albeit the Socialist Movement for Integration complained about voter irregularities, citing certain cities in particular, albeit seem to have broadly accepted the results. The president has so far come out with quite conciliatory comments, and there's no sign of him resigning, which it is not surprising, I think. The Democratic Party seems to have broadly accepted the results as well. And there also seems to be a leadership challenge going on against the party leader, Lujim Basha, who has been in something of a conflict with his party since becoming leader. And this is now the second election in a row that he's lost. So the it's understandable that there would now be kind of gathering momentum against him. It's also worth saying that Rama has now tried to sound a conciliatory tone, albeit in a very Rama way of going, well, now we've won, we invite everyone to come on board and support all the things that we're doing that are great for Albania.
Right. It was a decisive enough victory for them to just, you know, basically they can now pass their agenda.
Well, I mean, they've won a clear majority, which, I mean, is telling about Albanian politics on its own, that a party can win a majority in a system like this. There's also, controversies over whether the majority might even be bigger than it looks, because we spoke about this a little bit before the podcast started, but there's I mentioned the small Social Democratic Party. There's essentially a controversy around whether that party is in fact a kind of front for the Socialist Party to get more votes. And I think probably we don't have enough time to go into detail about that, but yeah, so that those three seats may in fact be kind of extra free votes for the Socialist Party.
Okay, do we have anything else that we want to mention about this election? Or is this a good place to end?
One thing I would like to mention, because I really love it, is Rama is a fascinating figure in many ways and came out. But his first, the job that he's really remembered for, he was mayor of Tirana. And when he was mayor of Tirana, he's a former artist, actually, and the son of someone who used to make statues of Hoxha, which is telling on all sorts of levels. He's a really fascinating guy in terms of, the controversies around him are clearly very real, but he's a former pedagogue and a writer, and he really is incredibly interesting. But when he became mayor of Tirana, his first big project was he had all the grey communist blocks in Tirana painted in kind of very vibrant colours. Which I would highly recommend anyone just go and take a look at. In many ways, his economic strategy for Albania is a tourism-based one. Albania is becoming something of a tourist hotspot, and the painted buildings in Tirana have become a reason to. I'm just going to, for my fellow podcastees, I'm just put in the chat some pictures so that you guys can see.
Yeah. Anyway, so I've actually known about this for a little bit, because there was it must have been about, I think, about 2008 now. There was Michael Palin, the famous English comedian and also a travel broadcaster, did a series, I think it was called New Europe, where he went around Eastern Europe, which had then only recently been admitted to the EU, and he goes to Tirana and interviews Rama while he was the mayor about the nicely multicolored buildings. And I very explicitly remember him going in, and basically his desk in the mayor's office, he just had pots and pots of kind of colored marker pens and big sheets of paper, and he was just sort of like drawings of buildings, painting them in very different colors.
Yeah, I mean, my partner, those listeners who know me will know my partner is Romanian and from Bucharest, and also someone who very much enjoys bright colors in day-to-day life. And so when I came across this, I showed her some photos, and she just immediately went, oh my god, I love that, please can we do that in Bucharest. So yeah, I mean, as a kind of mark of political branding, I quite like, you can see why people would be appealed by that as a background. So that's a pleasant point to kind of end on, I think. Is there any other questions you guys want to mention, or anything else?
Just a shout out to the party logos. I mean, the Socialist Party of Albania has a classic.
It does, fist doesn't and... it? It's a, but it's a very good logo as well as being kind of classic, I think.
With the yeah. It,
yeah.
Very good. Very yes. good.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some very good. There's a very small anti-corruption party that unfortunately didn't get anywhere that I quite like the logo of as well, which is called Hashtag Initiative. It's got like a bunch of arms overlaid each other, which I'm quite fond of. Unfortunately, it didn't get anywhere. Albeit, I don't know exactly how. Real their anti-corruption stances are because the people who started it are both from the Democratic Party, which has its own legacies of corruption, which, I mean, is one of the reasons why obviously these problems that Rama has faced obviously don't stick to him because the whole system is considered to be corrupt, as happened when we talked about Bulgaria. But the key difference is that Bulgaria in various ways is now seeing movements that are trying to solve the problem, which Albania is obviously not yet.
All right, so well, on that slightly down note, maybe we can we can leave it there.
Maybe you can go look at more pictures of Tirana. That's fine.
Let's see, try and remember the nicely painted buildings of Tirana.
Yes.
Rather than ongoing struggles with corruption. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Which I always. Yeah. I mean, hopefully we won't have to talk too much about the Balkans in the future because it does always get a little bit depressing. albeit we now have a Moldovan election happening in July, so that's fun. That's fun for everyone to look forward to.
Yeah. Well. We will see everyone next week, where we will be coming very close to home for two members of the team, I should think, because there is all kinds of elections taking place across the UK on Thursday, the 6th, isn't it?
Yes, although given if it does take 3 days to count, maybe we might want to do like a sneaky episode on Madrid before that.
Yes, we'll quite likely also see you to... some coverage of the Madrid elections as well.
I feel like I'm always doing Jonathan a favour there because I know you'd like to talk about
Madrid. It'd be quite nice, although I don't think the result is going to be particularly pleasant for people of our political persuasions.
No. I had a look at some of the polls this morning while I was looking for the final Albania results, and yes, they do not look pleasant.
Okay, and so see everyone next week for some unpleasant Madrid results.
So but more reasons to be sad about the world.
Okay, all right. Please do rate and subscribe wherever you're listening, and follow us on Twitter where we're at Ballot World. Have a good week, everyone.
Yeah.